My castaway this week is an actress. Today, she's the only surviving British star of the silent screen. But in the 30s, she also starred in hugely successful talkies, such as Carnival and Gypsy. Her personal life has been as vivid as the films with which she made her name. Howard Hughes proposed to her twice, but she ended up marrying men who let her down. She also walked out on a Hollywood contract with Warner Brothers, which meant she was blackballed and unable to make another film. She turned instead to the stage and, in her own phrase, just plodded on. "I'm hanging on by my fingernails to the end of the century," she says. "It's been the most fantastic of all time." She is Chilly Boucher. Yours is indeed a fantastic story, Chilly. I suppose, in a sense, you were really the first sex symbol of the British screen, weren't you?
Yes, I was. I was the English Clara Bow, or the English It Girl, and we weren't allowed to say sex in those days, so it was it and not sex.
It was sex appeal.
It was sex appeal,
but yes. You got that across even in silent films, so how did you do it?
I don't know. I just looked different to everybody else, I think. I had this mad mop of black curly hair and I was unfashionably plump. And everybody had to look like a beanpole in those days.
Plump as in curvaceous.
Curvaceous, oh, yes. Fat. Yeah, not fat. Oh, no. In the right places.
Mm. And it was the eyes, though, really, wasn't it?
Yes, they've always been a feature of, I'm afraid, of me.
Why are you afraid?
Well, I don't know.
They got you into trouble.
They did, because they seemed to know more than I did know. The eyes seemed to convey more. I remember one director saying, "That's a clever girl. She looks at everybody in the same way." And I wasn't conscious of looking at anybody in any particular way.
So they cast you in the naughty parts.
In the naughty parts. Naughty eyes. Yes, I rarely played good girls.
Rarely played?
Rarely. Sometimes, yes.
What about the casting couch? You must therefore have been the victim of many occasions.
I didn't have too much trouble at first because they did know how young I was. But it was a little later on I started, when I became a more sophisticated actress, that I started to have bits of trouble with directors and producers.
You've written about undignified struggles in Herbert Wilcox's office.
That's
the film director's office.
Yes.
Well, he thought that he should have his pound of flesh if he was going to make you a star, did he?
Well, he did make me a star. He did work very, very hard, but he wanted something back in return, which I wasn't prepared to give.
But, I mean, there wasn't just one man after you. You've always had men falling about every time.
Yes.
you've gone anywhere, haven't you?
I have.
What do you put it down to, though, Chilly? It just can't just be the eyes.
I don't know what it is, but I did notice it right from a girl that the men came to me, like my brothers. School chums and cricket chums, they came round in hordes, not one at a time, but they all hung around the garden gate. And
but you've never analysed it?
No, I've never analysed it. I think I'm a happy person, always have been a happy person. Maybe that was something to do with it.
Tell me about your first record.
Ah, well, I'm choosing this record because everybody, when they meet me, always says, "Where did you get your name from? Where did you get Chilly from?" So I have to say that it came from a song. I love my Chilly Bomb Bomb.
You've heard about the kind of girls that men forget. Well, here's a baby you'll remember all your life, I'll bet. Believe me, I have a lot of fun with Chilly Bomb Bomb, 'cause Chilly Bomb Bomb loves me.
I love my Chilly Bomb Bomb, sung by Fred Hartley and his band. So tell me about Chilly Bomb Bomb. Who gave you the name? It was at Harrods, wasn't it?
Yes, it was when I was working at Harrods. I was either 15 or 16, I've forgotten which. And I worked in the small ladies' gown department, and I had two followers, one Welshman and another man. And this Welshman one day walked into the department and said, "I love my Chilly Bomb Bomb." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, last night I went to a show called The Punch Bowl, and Sunny Hale and a girl with a big mop of dark curly hair who looked just like you sang it with him, and he said, Chilly Bomb Bomb. So my colleagues thought it was fun, and they took it up to Chilly Bomb Bomb, then took it down to Chilly, And when I went into films, the agent said, it's an unusual name, Chilli, keep it. They'll remember it, the audience will remember it.
Because you were Dorothy, really.
I was born Dorothy, yes.
Tell me about Harrods in those days, because I think it was already in the 1920s using its catchphrase, escape into another world. What sort of world was it behind the scenes where you were?
Well, backstage Harrods is just like any place. It's just plain walls and whitewashed walls. Then you open a door and you go into one of these glorious salons, you know.
But it was quite Dickensian, wasn't it, in the way it was run?
Oh, the management were very, very, very strict indeed, yes, very strict.
And what did they look like, the managers, as they prowled around the store?
Well, the big boss, Sir Woodman Burbage, he wore a black frock coat, striped trousers and top hat. Really, that, you know, it was terribly funny, really, we thought.
And were you terrified of them?
Absolutely petrified. He used to do a daily walk around the shop with his sidekick, Mr. Chittum. And when we saw them coming in the distance, we'd go and hide in one of the dressing rooms.
Because you became a kind of mannequin in the small ladies' department,
yes.
Didn't you? And so you were sometimes there wearing very revealing frocks.
Yes. Yes, Miss Richards, the buyer, she'd say, come along, dear, put on a dress today and walk around the department. I'd never undressed before except at the seaside, and I was felt very much exposed with one of these 1920s beaded evening dresses. And I'd hide behind a pillar half the time. I wouldn't show myself.
but it all ended in tears. Well, worse than tears, really. It ended in disgrace you tell me about it.
Well, there was this other young man. I told you about the Welsh boy, and there was this other young man who I preferred, and of course I would, being me, I'd prefer the cad to the nice man. And he said, I'm going to take you up west to dinner one night, and I thought, this is terribly exciting. I'd never been up west, and I was only 16. And we went to the Regent Palace Hotel, which I thought was a wonderful place, had dinner, we came out. And he said, will you trust me, Chilli? I said, yes, of course I'll trust you. We got into a taxi and went a long, long ride, it seemed, and finished up in a terrible-looking street, dark Victorian houses. And I thought he was going visiting. But I thought, funny place to go visiting. Went into one of these nasty houses, and he talked to a lady and went into a room, came out, went up some stairs and opened a door. I thought, a funny place to be visiting. It's not very nice. Then when he opened the door and I saw this dreadful room with one single light bulb in the ceiling and a double bed and nothing much else, I knew what I was there for. And being a silly girl and adventurous, I, instead of running home, I stayed and didn't like it at all. It was an awful letdown.
And the management of Harrods found out.
It got to their ears.
And that was the end of you.
Sent for my mother, which was a terrible thing. I saw her coming into the department looking white and drawn. And they said, I'm afraid she's got to go. And it was a dreadful thing for my parents.
Can you still feel the shame of it somewhere inside you? Do you still...
Only for them. I wasn't ashamed. No, I wasn't ashamed, not really. I pretended to the girls the next morning that I'd enjoyed it, but I hated it. Perhaps if I'd enjoyed it, I might feel shame.
Anyway, you were sacked. You were out on your ear.
I was sacked.
Tell me about record number two.
Ah, well, this is strange, because although it was the silent era at the time, my first job in front of a camera was in a talkie. Well, it wasn't a talkie, it was a soundie. An American singer sang songs, and I wobbled about in the background doing the Charleston and things. He sang Ain't She Sweet, this American singer, and I danced to it.
Ain't she sweet, see you coming down the street. Now I ask you very confidentially, ain't she sweet? Ain't she nice, look her over once or twice. Now I ask you very confidentially, ain't she nice? Just cast an eye in her direction. Oh me, oh my, ain't that perfection? I repeat, don't think that's kind of neat. And I ask you very confidently.
Ain't she sweet, with Ray Starita and the Piccadilly Revels Band. So the sacking from Harrods was a blessing in disguise, because it meant you could pursue your ambition to be a film star.
That's right.
You answered an ad, didn't you?
I did.
What did it say?
It said, remake film stars, price 3 guineas. And I thought, well, that's cheap at the price. I went along to this place. It was a ramshackle old place off Oxford Street. I went up some rickety stairs, and there was a man sitting at the top. And I said, I want to be join the film star school, please. He said, well, there's one going to start now. Would you like to go in there? So I went in, and there were a lot of very funny people sitting around. None of them would ever be a film star. And I was very young at the time, but I knew it was completely phony set up. And the second day, there was a tall young man out standing by this man. And he said, this is Reggie Newman. He's from Water Street, and he wants you to do a commercial for him, a film commercial, not a television commercial, of course. And so he booked me to be at Hendon Aerodrome the following day in a summer dress, and that was my first job.
So you were spotted, really?
I was spotted.
Yes. Amazing piece of luck, really.
I'll never know if the man at the desk phoned this man in Water Street and said, we've got a girl I think will photograph well, or whether he just came looking for somebody, I shall never know.
And you were very, very soon making, I think, a movie every 6 weeks or something.
Oh, I was working very, very hard.
And you had to trapeze off the Eiffel Tower in one of them, is that right?
Well, no, I didn't trapeze off the Eiffel Tower. I had to jump off the Eiffel Tower. We were right at the very top where the public don't go, and I was supposed to jump into thin air with a parachute. And they had the cameras behind me, and I stood on a ledge. And below me was another ledge of about 2 or 3 feet wide with one single iron rail around it. That's all there was between me and the boulevards of Paris below. And as I jumped, it looked as if I was jumping into space.
Must have felt like it, too.
I was terrified. In the film, which I have seen recently, you can see I don't really jump, I sort of slither.
And this was called The City of Play?
Yes.
But that one, as I understand it, turned into a talkie, began life as a silent film,
halfway
turned into
through.
A talkie halfway through.
Yes.
Why?
Well, when we came back from Paris, Harold Jolson had arrived with a jazz singer, and talkies had come to stay. We had the first sound man Bainer Monnery, he was the first sound man, he was installed in the studio, and his voice came through a megaphone that was attached to the ceiling, and that's how it all started. He would say, speak up, Miss Boucher, because I had a little tiny squeaky voice.
And what did you think when you first heard yourself on the movies?
I knew I had to do something about my vowels, which were rather Fulhamish, rather weak, I thought. I had a tiny part in a film with Sybil Thorndike, and one day she was calling to address her across the studio, and she said, darling, bring me my powder. And I thought, well, that sounds nice, powder. And I said it, powder. I said, no, that's Fulhamish, no. So I started to get my vowels. I never had any trouble. I mean, I went straight into talkies.
Record number 3.
In the silent days, we used to have a little three-piece orchestra playing for us during our scenes, and we were allowed to choose our own mood music. I had Ain't She Sweet or Sweet Sue for the jolly scenes, and I had a number called Songs My Mother Taught Me for the sad scenes and the love scenes.
Songs My Mother Taught Me, sung by the Cliff Adams Singers. Chilly Boucher, you married a matinee idol called Harry Milton. You were 20 years old, I think, when you got married. It was a fairy tale wedding, wasn't it? Tell me about the day itself.
No, it wasn't such a fairy tale wedding, actually. We didn't have a big wedding, no.
Well, I mean, fairy tale in the sense that Gracie Fields came along because he was starring with it. And then that evening you went on stage with them.
Yes, he was playing in the show's The Thing with Gracie. After we'd had the reception and everything, we went home and mother and my father and I went to the theatre, sat in the box.
The Royal Box.
In the Royal Box. And Gracie came down in her solo number and she just stood underneath the box and sang straight at me, "Sweetheart, this is heaven." And it was terribly, terribly moving.
But she had you up on stage at the end.
At the end, somebody hauled me out of the box. I wasn't expecting it. And all by myself, I came down the steps and the band played the wedding march. And
what were you wearing?
I was wearing a new dress that I bought at Harrods. I bought all my clothes at Harrods.
Small ladies' department.
Small ladies' department. It was a Paris model in a black net. It cost 80 guineas. It was the price of it. And Miss Richards, my buyer from the Small Ladies, gave it to me for 40 guineas as a wedding present.
So you felt beautiful.
Oh, I did, yes.
And then you and Harry rushed off to the Grand Hotel in Eastbourne for the night because he had to be back the next day to on stage with Gracie. And unlike the chap in Paddington, Harry was a good lover, was he?
What? Not on the first night. He was too drunk and too tired.
But it turned out all right in the end.
It turned out all right in the end, yes.
So everything in the garden was lovely for a year, 18 months
yes,
or so.
Yes, right.
And then he started having an affair with another leading star of the time, Jessie Matthews.
Yes.
Very successful young actress. What was the first you knew of it?
He just admitted it one night when he was very drunk. He said, she opened her mouth to me during a stage kiss, and that was it.
He was besotted with her, wasn't he? Mm. But what was so deeply hurtful for you, as I understand it, was it was a very public affair. Everybody knew about it.
Everybody in London knew about it but me, yes. Mm. But looking back, people tried to tell me.
But in the end, she went off him.
Well, when it came out into the open, she didn't want to play anymore.
And his heart was broken. And he took his revenge in a rather dramatic manner, didn't he?
I don't think Harry's heart was broken. I think what he did, he was getting his sense of humour back, what he did. He took up a gypsy moth, flew over her garden and dropped matchboxes with a single raspberry in each one on her lawn. Now, that to me is not a broken heart. If it had been, it would have been a little rosebud, knowing Harry. It was a raspberry. He was giving her the raspberry.
But as a result, he was blackballed, wasn't he?
Well, Sonny Hale, her husband, who is still her husband, he was a member of the West End Managers Association and had him blackballed, and that was the end of Harry as an actor.
But horribly painful for you, really, to be betrayed like that.
Oh, it was dreadful at the time, yes, absolutely dreadful.
Next piece of music.
After the despair and the loneliness, I was in a show in London and I was invited by a man called Teddy Joyce to appear as his guest at the Kit Kat where he was playing. He was an American band leader that just came over and taken London by storm. And he had the spotlight play on me as I went into the restaurant and then strode over, took me in his arms, like a real showman he was, and took me around the floor. And we danced beautifully together, cheek to cheek. It was a new technique, cheek to cheek, as they did in America. And I thought he was the most romantic thing that I'd seen for a long time, and I hadn't been held by a man for a few years. I saw him again a couple of times, and I couldn't forget him. I just thought that he was terrific.
January, because I'm in love. It's always a spring in my heart with you in my arms. The snow is just white blossoms that fall from above. And here is the reason, my dear, your magical charms.
June in January, sung by Jack Plant and played by Teddy Joyce and his orchestra. Teddy Joyce, the heartthrob American bandleader of the 30s, who was the love of your life, Chili Boucher. Is that fair?
Yes, it's true to say that, yes.
Tell me about him. What happened? You had a wonderful time together, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We were both very, very busy doing our own different thing, me filming and he did tours and everything. But we managed to get together at weekends and it was all great fun, and about 1937 we became engaged.
So you'd have been, what, about 27, 26,
yes.
27?
Yes.
You got engaged, you bought a house?
Yes.
Everything was going splendidly?
Everything was going splendidly, yes.
And then what?
He died. He died in 1941 at the age of 36.
How? Why?
He came home with what we thought was a bad dose of flu. In 3 days he was dead. It was cerebrospinal fever, which is a very, very virulent form of meningitis. He was a terribly, terribly strong person, but he just went to a skeleton in 3 days and died. I wasn't married to him, but I was on the phone to the nurse at the hospital that night. I said, I can't sleep, sister. She said, well, come and if you'd like to come and sit here and wait. I said, yes, please. And she said, no, just a minute, dear. No, don't come. She said, don't come, Mrs. Joyce. Mr. Joyce has just passed away. Still crying. But I say, nobody had called me Mrs. Joyce until that moment of his death. So I say she married us as he died.
And you never really got over it?
Oh, no, I couldn't get over a thing like that, ever. He was such a vital person that it was impossible to believe that he'd gone. And he hasn't gone. I mean, he's with me.
We should have the next record.
Well, his signature tune was The World is Waiting for the Sunrise, and it was very lovely because when we did announce our engagement, as I say, he was away a lot. If I was at home and I went to one of the big, all the big places like the Dorchester and Grosvenor House, Ciro's, Café de Paris, Café Anglais, they all had their big, wonderful bands playing in those days. And if I walked in alone or with an escort, the band leaders would see me stop playing what they were playing and play The World is Waiting for the Sunrise, which was a lovely, lovely moment. I walked very proudly to my seat.
Is Waiting for the Sunrise, the signature tune of Teddy Joyce, but played on that recording by Ackerbilk and his band. Apart from your many overt fans, Chili, you had some closet ones too, didn't you? And one of them was Howard Hughes. Tell me about him.
After I had made the film Carnival, Wilcox said, please, Chili, one night, pop into a little private cinema in Wardour Street and there's a man there watching your films and he wants to meet you. And there was this tall, rather handsome, nice-looking young man sitting all alone watching my films. I knew his name was Howard Hughes, and I knew that he was a producer from America, but that's about all I knew about him. I didn't know that he was a billionaire or anything like that. Anyway, finally we got talking. He was very shy, very retiring, very quietly spoken, never with anybody else, always alone. And he asked me to go to Hollywood to make a film for him. And I didn't want to go. No, I was married to Harry. And I didn't want to go to Hollywood anyway. And on we went, and then one night he proposed marriage. to me. And I was so astonished because he was so quiet.
And he'd never taken you out or anything? You just sat in the cinema with him?
He'd not even touched me. He didn't even touch me. He never even sat by me. He just stood in front of me looking down. And I said, well, I'm terribly sorry, but I'm married. He said, oh, I'm sorry, Dorothy. And I thought, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, it's all going to happen again. I'm going to get into trouble again, and all mixed up and things. So I didn't go in to see him anymore. But one morning, a couple of weeks later, the phone rang at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was Hughes on the ship that he was going to return to America, pleading with me to go with him. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't want to leave my husband. And he just said, oh, well, goodbye, Dorothy.
Have you ever wished you'd accepted?
No.
Not even when Harry went off with Jessie Matthews?
No, I think things are meant to be. I wasn't meant to be Mrs. Howard Hughes, and the one thing I do regret, all his ladies and his leading ladies, he put on a pension for life. So that's what I missed.
Could do with that.
Next piece of music.
Hopefully, when I'm sitting on my desert island and watching a beautiful sunset, I would like to hear this music. I shall be thinking of Teddy and Mum and Dad and my brother and everybody that's gone, I think, and just be quiet and listen to this beautiful piece of Tchaikovsky.
Part of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite, played by the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by Mark Ermler. You made more than 50 films, 55, 56, I think, in your time, Chile.
Yes.
But never one in Hollywood. Now,
no.
Why didn't you like Hollywood? Because you went out there, didn't you?
I went out there under contract to Warner Brothers, and I ran away after a few months.
But why? You went out because you'd had such a success with Gypsy, which was a Warner Brothers film, and you got there, and what happened?
I just hated it. I didn't like the atmosphere. I didn't like the people. I mean, I loved the sun and the scenery. It was beautiful. But it was the vibes of all these rather strange people that had all got together, all making films, but they weren't really nice people.
So you made this huge decision to travel back home, and it was a long journey then. I mean, you went by boat, presumably.
Yes, oh, yes. Yes. Didn't fly in those days.
And did you realise what an enormous decision that was and what the consequences could be?
Oh, no, I didn't, no. I didn't think that Jack Warner, who was my boss, I didn't think he'd notice I'd gone. I mean, it's such a big studio, the big stars, Bette Davis and all those people. I didn't think he'd notice that I'd gone, but he did. And sent a telegram to the little studio at Warner's at Teddington to say when her six-monthly option comes up, she's out. And he didn't only do that, he just blacklisted me with every other studio.
And he never forgave you?
Never forgave me, no.
Do you regret then walking out? I mean, you really did for your career in films, didn't you?
Yes, but I went into the theatre, and people don't seem to realise that. They just think I finished working then, but I didn't. I started to work very hard in the theatre after that.
Record number 7.
One of the films I made was at Welwyn Garden City during the war, and there was this assistant director called Bluey Hill. He was a lovely Australian with a lovely smiling face and red hair and green eyes. And we became very friendly and very, very jolly. And then the war went on and we went our different ways, made different pictures, and I saw him occasionally. And then much, much later, end of the 40s, I moved into Dolphin Square, and a fellow tenant was Bluey. And as the time went by, we got together, and finally he was the man that I spent the rest of my life with after that. When we first got together and went around, the Third Man film was showing, and the Harry Lime theme on the zither was sort of Top of the Pops. So that's the one that I always remember Bluey from when I hear it.
Theme played by Anton Karas, and a theme tune for you, Chili Boucher, and your third husband, who, unlike the first two, wasn't a rotter at all.
That's right.
And with whom you lived very happily until his death about 10 years ago now.
Yes.
Yours has been a life of incredible highs and lows. How do you feel looking back across it at the age of 86? Do you think the game was worth the candle?
Oh, yes, there have been wonderful moments, wonderful highs and awful lows.
And do you materially have anything to show for it, or is it all gone one way or another?
No, very little to show for it.
The rotter husbands, I think, did for a lot of the cash you had in the early days, didn't they?
Yes.
Drank it away.
That's right. I was just a bad picker, I think, as far as men were concerned. But by the time I met Bluey, I was more mature, and I looked for something other than good looks. Perhaps I shouldn't have gone for the good looks.
That's the moral of the story.
I think so, yes.
Now, what about you, briefly, on this desert island? Are you going to be able to look after yourself alone on a desert island?
Oh, yes, I'm sure I would. I think I'd find plenty to do. I would look to the flora, because I'm very fond of flowers and growing things. I'd try and find all the lovely new flowers, orchids and things. I wouldn't look much to the fauna, because I might find some creepy crawlies that I didn't like. But even those I've come to deal with, like spiders and things, I always say, look at the size of that spider and look at the size of yourself. Don't be so silly.
And whatever else, you could make marks in the sand to make sure you got to the millennium, to the end of this century.
Ah, yes. Yes, of course I would do that.
Last record, please.
Well, this is a thrill. This is for me on my desert island to get thrills up and down my spine. I want the three tenors, please, singing O Sole Mio.
Luciano Pavarotti, Placido Domingo and José Carrera singing O Sole Mio in concert in Rome in July 1990. Now, if you could only take one of the eight records, Chili, which one would it be?
Oh, the world is waiting for the sunrise.
Teddy's signature tune?
Yes.
And what about your book? You've got the Bible and you've got Shakespeare waiting for you.
Have I?
Mm.
Out there?
Mm. They're already there on the beach.
Aren't they? Oh, well, I would rather like to have taken my autobiography, because it's got lots of nice pictures of my family and people, and it would be almost like taking a photographic album as well. But perhaps it is a little self-indulgent. So I've got a lovely little book called In Tune with the Infinite by Ralph Waldo Trine, which is a simply written little book, but it has a wonderful message in it. It is really philosophy. Sort of little book that you can just delve into when you're feeling perhaps a bit down and you'll soon feel up.
And what about your luxury?
Well, I expect I'm going to ask what all the girls ask for. My makeup kit. I must have that with me.
Couldn't live without it.
No, couldn't live without it.
Julie Bouchier, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
A great pleasure.